Side 8, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 342. They struggled manfully to push a beam out over the narrow lane, a task made more difficult by the fact that their leverage diminished as they shoved the beam out farther and farther. Finally, the stubborn beam clunked down on top of the consulate wall. They slid several more beams across along its top, then rolled them to one side to form a narrow bridge. As they were shoving the last one across, Hurek suddenly stopped with a muttered oath. "What's wrong?" Sparhawk asked him. "How did we get up on this roof, Sparhawk?" Hurek asked acidly. "We climbed up a slanted beam." "Where did we want to go?" "To the top of the wall of the consulate over there." "Then why are we building bridges?" "Because..." Sparhawk stopped, feeling suddenly very foolish. "We could have just leaned a beam against the wall of the consulate, couldn't we?" "Congratulations, my lord," Hurek said sarcastically. "The bridge was such a perfect solution to the problem," Sparhawk said defensively. "But totally unnecessary." "That doesn't really invalidate the solution, does it?" "Of course not." "Why don't we just go on across?"
"You go ahead. I think I'll go talk with the naked lady for a while."
"Never mind, Curic. She has her mind on other things. I'm sort of an expert on fertility, if that's what's really bothering her." "Let's go, Curic." They crossed their makeshift bridge to the top of the consulate wall, and then crept along it until they reached a place where the branches of a well-watered fig tree reached up out of the shadows below. They climbed down the tree and stood for a moment or two beside it while Sparhawk got his bearings. "You wouldn't happen to know where the consul's bedchamber is, would you?" Hurek whispered. "No," Sparhawk replied softly. "But I can guess. It's the Alanian consulate, and all official Alanian buildings are more or less the same. The private quarters will be upstairs in the back."
"Very good, Sparhawk," Hurek said dryly. "That narrows things down considerably. Now we only have to search about a quarter of the building."
They crept through a shadowy garden and entered by way of an unlocked back door. They passed through a darkened kitchen and into the dimly lit central hall. Hurek suddenly jerked Sparhawk back into the kitchen.
"What?"
Sparhawk started to object in a hoarse whisper.
"Shh."
Out in the hall there was the bobbing glow of a candle. A matronly woman, a housekeeper, or perhaps a cook, walked toward the kitchen door. Sparhawk shrank back as she stood framed in the doorway. Then she took hold of the handle and firmly closed the door.
"How did you know she was coming?" Sparhawk whispered.
"I don't know," Hurek whispered back. "I just did." He put his ear to the door.
"She's moving on," he reported softly.
"What's she doing up at this time of the night?"
"Who knows? Maybe she's just making sure all the doors are locked, as Lottie does that every night."
He listened again. "There," he said. "She just closed another door, and I can't hear her out there anymore. I think she went to bed."
"The staircase should be just opposite the main entryway," Sparhawk whispered. "Let's get up on the second floor before somebody else comes wandering by."
They darted out into the hallway and up a broad flight of stairs to the upper floor.
"Look for an ornate door," Sparhawk whispered. "The consul's the master of the house, so he's likely to have the most luxurious room. You go that way, and I'll go this."
They separated and went in opposite directions on tiptoe. At the end of the hallway, Sparhawk found an elaborately carved door decorated with gilt paint. He opened it carefully and looked inside. By the light of a single dimly glowing oil lamp, he saw a stout, florid-faced man of 50 or so lying on his back in the bed. The man was snoring loudly. Sparhawk recognized him. He softly closed the door and went looking for Curic. His squire met him at the head of the stairs.
"How old a man is the consul?" Curic whispered.
"About 50.
"The one I saw wasn't him, then. There's a carved door at the far end. There's a young fellow about 20 in bed with an older woman."
"Did they see you?"
"No.
They were busy."
"Oh. The consul's sleeping alone. He's down at this end of the hall. Do you suppose the woman at the other end could be his wife? That's their business, isn't it? Together they tiptoed back down to the gilt-painted door. Sparhawk eased it open, and they went inside and crossed the floor to the bed. Sparhawk reached out and took the consul's shoulder. "Your Excellency," he said quietly, shaking the man. The consul's eyes flew open, then glazed and went blank as Keurig wrapped him sharply behind the ear with the hilt of his dagger. They trussed the unconscious man up in a dark blanket, and Keurig unceremoniously slung the limp form over his shoulder. "Is that everything we need here?" he asked. "That's it," Sparhawk said. "Let's go." They crept back down the stairs and into the kitchen again. Sparhawk carefully closed the door leading into the main part of the house. "Wait here," he breathed to Keurig. "Let me check the garden. I'll whistle if it's clear." He slipped out into the shadowed garden and carefully moved from tree to tree, his eyes alert. He suddenly realized that he was enjoying himself immensely. He hadn't had so much pure fun since he and Calton had been boys and had regularly slipped out of his father's house in the middle of the night bent on mischief. He whistled a very poor imitation of a nightingale. After a moment he heard Keurig's hoarse whisper coming from the kitchen door. "Is that you?" For an instant he was tempted to whisper back, "No," but then he got himself under control again. They had some difficulty getting the inert body of the consul up the fig tree, but finally managed by main strength. Then they crossed their makeshift bridge and pulled the beams back onto the roof. "She's still there," Keurig whispered. "Who is?" "The naked lady." "It's her roof." They dragged the beams back to the far side of the roof and lowered them again. Then Sparhawk climbed down and caught the consul's body when Keurig lowered it to him. Keurig joined him a moment later, and they restacked the beams against the wall. "All nice and neat," Sparhawk said with satisfaction, brushing his hands together. Keurig hefted the body up onto his shoulder again. "Won't his wife miss him?" he asked. "Not very much, I wouldn't think, if that was her in the bedroom at the other end of the hall. Why don't we go back to the monastery?" They traded off carrying the body and reached the outskirts of town in about half an hour, dodging several watchmen along the way. The consul, draped over Sparhawk's shoulder, groaned and stirred weakly. Keurig rapped him on the head again. When they entered the abbot's study, Keurig unceremoniously dumped the unconscious man on the floor. He and Sparhawk looked at each other for a moment, then they both burst into uncontrollable laughter. "What's so funny?" the abbot demanded. "You should have come along, my lord," Keurig gasped. "I haven't had so much fun in years." He began laughing again. "The bridge was the best, I think." "I sort of like the naked lady," Sparhawk disagreed. "Have you two been drinking?" the abbot asked suspiciously. "Not a drop, my lord," Sparhawk replied. "It's a thought, though, if you've got anything handy. Where's Sophronia?" "I persuaded her that she and the child should get some sleep." The abbot paused. "What naked lady?" he demanded, his eyes afire with curiosity. "There was a woman up on a roof going through that fertility ritual," Sparhawk told him, still laughing. "She sort of distracted Keurig for a moment or two." "Was she pretty?" the abbot grinned at Keurig. "I couldn't really say, my lord. I wasn't looking at her face." "My lord abbot," Sparhawk said then a bit more seriously, though he still felt enormously exuberant. "We're going to question Aelius as soon as he wakes up. Please don't be alarmed by some of the things we say to him." "I quite understand, Sparhawk," the abbot replied. "Good. All right, Keurig, let's wake up His Excellency here and see what he has to say for himself." Keurig stripped the blanket off the consul's limp body and began pinching the unconscious man's ears and nose. After a moment, the consul's eyelids fluttered. Then he groaned and opened his eyes. He stared blankly at them for a moment and sat up quickly. "Who are you? What's the meaning of this?" he demanded. Keurig smacked him firmly across the back of the head. "You see how it is, Aelius," Sparhawk said blandly. "You don't mind if I call you Aelius, do you? Possibly you may remember me. The name's Sparhawk." "Sparhawk?" the consul gasped. "I thought you were dead." That's a highly exaggerated rumor, Alias. Now, the fact of the matter is that you've been abducted. We have a number of questions for you. Things will go much more pleasantly for you if you answer them freely. Otherwise, you're in for a very bad night.
You wouldn't dare!
Hurek hit him again.
I'm the consul of the Kingdom of Elania,
Alias blustered, trying to cover the back of his head with both hands.
And the cousin of the primate of Cimera. You can't do this to me!
Sparhawk sighed. Break a few of his fingers, Kurek, he suggested, just to show him that we can do this to him. Kurek set his foot against the consul's chest, pushed him back onto the floor, and seized the weakly struggling captive's right wrist.
No!
Alias squealed.
Don't! I'll tell you anything you want.
I told you he'd cooperate, my lord, Sparhawk said conversationally to the abbot, pulling off his renderish robe to stand revealed in his mail coat and sword belt, just as soon as he understood the seriousness of the situation.
Your methods are direct, Sir Sparhawk, the abbot noted.
I'm a plain man, my lord, Sparhawk replied, scratching at one mailed armpit. Subtlety isn't one of my strong points. He nudged the captive with one foot. All right, then, Alias, I'll make things simple for you. All you have to do at first is confirm a number of statements. He drew up a chair and sat down, crossing his legs. First of all, your cousin, the primate of Cimera, has his eyes on the throne of the Archprelacy, right?
You have no proof of that.
Break his thumb, Kurek. Still holding the consul's wrist in his grip, Kurek pried open the man's clenched fist and grasped his thumb. In how many places, my lord? He asked politely. Do as many as you can, Kurek. Give him something to think about.
No, no! It's true,
Alias gasped, his eyes wide with terror. We're making real progress here, Sparhawk observed with a relaxed smile. Now, you've had dealings in the past with a white-haired man named Martell. He works for your cousin from time to time. Am I right?
Yes.
Alias faltered. Notice how it gets easier as you go along? In fact, it was you who set Martell and his hirelings on me that night about 10 years ago, wasn't it?
It was his idea,
Alias blurted quickly.
I'd received orders from my cousin to cooperate with him. He suggested that I summon you that night. I had no idea that he intended to kill you.
You're very naive, then, Alias. Lately, a fair number of travelers from the Northern Kingdoms have been circulating rumors here in Cypria that there's a groundswell of sympathy for renderish aims in those kingdoms. Is Martell in any way connected with that campaign? Alias stared at him, his lips pressed fearfully shut. Slowly, Kurek began to bend his thumb back.
Yes, yes!
Alias squeaked, arching back in pain. You were almost backsliding there, Alias, Sparhawk chided. I'd watch that if I were you. The whole purpose of Martell's campaign here is to persuade the city dwellers of Rendor to join with the desert nomads in an Ashandist uprising against the church. Am I right?
Martell doesn't confide in me all that much, but I suppose that's his ultimate goal, yes.
And he's supplying weapons, right?
I've heard that he is.
This next one is tricky, Alias, so listen carefully. The real point here is to stir things up so that the church knights will have to come here and quiet them down again. Isn't that so? Alias nodded sullenly.
Martell himself hasn't said so, but my cousin intimated as much to me in his last letter.
And the uprising is to be timed to coincide with the election of the new archprelate in the Basilica of Kyrillos?
I really don't know that, Sir Sparhawk. Please believe me. You're probably right, but I can't really say for certain.
We'll let that one pass for the moment. Now, I have a burning curiosity. Just where is Martell right now?
He's gone to Dabur to talk with Arashim. The old man's trying to whip his followers into a frenzy so that they'll start burning churches and expropriating church lands. Martell was very upset when he heard about it, and he hurried to Dabur to try to head it off.
Probably because it was premature?
I'd imagine as much, yes.
I guess that's about all, then, Alias, Sparhawk said benignly. I certainly want to thank you for your cooperation tonight.
You're letting me go?
The consul asked incredulously.
No, I'm afraid not.
Martell's an old friend of mine. I want to surprise him when I get to Davour, so I can't risk having you get word to him that I'm coming. There's a penitent cell down in the cellar of this monastery. I'm sure you feel very penitent just now, and I want to give you some time to reflect on your sins. The cell is quite comfortable, I'm told. It has a door, four walls, a ceiling, and even a floor. He looked at the abbot. It does have a floor, doesn't it, my lord? Oh, yes, the abbot confirmed. A nice cold stone one.
You can't do that!
Aelius protested shrilly. Sparhawk, Curic agreed. You really can't confine a man in a penitent cell against his will. It's a violation of church law. Oh, Sparhawk said peckishly, I suppose you're right. I did want to avoid all the mess. Go ahead and do it the other way, then. Yes, my lord, Curic said respectfully. He drew his dagger. Tell me, my lord abbot, he said, does your monastery have a graveyard?
Yes, rather a nice one, actually.
Oh, good. I hate just to drag them out into the open countryside and leave them for the jackals. He took hold of the consul's hair and tipped his head back. Then he set the edge of his dagger against the cringing man's throat. This won't take a moment, Your Excellency, he said professionally.
My lord abbot!
Aelius squealed. I'm afraid it's altogether out of my hands, Your Excellency, the abbot said with mock piety. The church knights have their own laws. I wouldn't dream of interfering.
Please, my lord abbot,
Aelius pleaded,
confine me to the penitent cell.
Do you sincerely repent your sins? The abbot asked.
Yes, yes, I am heartily ashamed.
I am afraid, Sir Sparhawk, that I must intercede on this penitent's behalf, the abbot said. I cannot permit you to kill him until he has made his peace with God. That's your final decision, my lord abbot? Sparhawk asked. I'm afraid it is, Sir Sparhawk. Oh, all right. Let us know as soon as he's completed his penance. Then we'll kill him.
Of course, Sir Sparhawk.
After the violently trembling Aelius had been taken away by a pair of burly monks, the three men in the room began to laugh. That was rare, my lord, Sparhawk congratulated the abbot. It was exactly the right tone. I'm not a complete novice at this sort of thing, Sparhawk, the abbot said. He looked at the big Pandion shrewdly. You Pandions have a reputation for brutality, particularly where questioning captives is concerned. It seems to me I've heard some rumors to that effect, yes, Sparhawk admitted. But you don't really do anything to people, do you? Not usually, no. It's the reputation that persuades people to cooperate. Do you have any idea how hard and messy it is actively to torture people? We planted those rumors about our order ourselves. After all, why work if you don't have to? My feelings exactly, Sparhawk. Now, the abbot said eagerly, why don't you tell me about the naked lady and the bridge and anything else you might have run across? Don't leave anything out. I'm only a poor cloistered monk, and I don't really get much fun out of life. Chapter 20 Sparhawk winced and drew his breath in sharply. Sophronia, do you have to dig straight in? He complained. Don't be such a baby, she told him, continuing to pick at the sliver in his hand with her needle. If I don't get it all out, it's going to fester. He sighed and gritted his teeth together as she continued to probe. He looked at Flute, who had both hands across her mouth as if to stifle a giggle. You think it's funny? He asked her crossly. She lifted her pipes and blew a derisive little trill. I've been thinking, Sparhawk, the abbot said. If Aeneas has people in Jirok the same as he has here in Cypria, wouldn't it be safer just to go around it and avoid the possibility of being recognized? I think we'll have to chance it, my lord, Sparhawk said. I've got a friend in Jirok I need to talk with before we go upriver. He looked down at his black robe. These ought to get us past a casual glance. I think it's dangerous, Sparhawk. Not if we're careful, I hope. Curic, who had been saddling their horses and loading the pack mule the abbot had given them, came into the room. He was carrying a long, narrow wooden case. Do you really have to take this? He asked Sophronia.
Yes, Curic,
she replied in a sad voice.
I do.
What's in it? A pair of swords. They're a part of the burden I bear.
It's a pretty large box for only two swords.
There'll be others, I'm afraid, she sighed, then began to wrap Sparhawk's hand with a strip of linen cloth.
It doesn't need a bandage, Sophronia, he objected. It was only a splinter.
She gave him a long, steady stare. He gave up.
All right, he said. Do whatever you think is best.
Thank you.
She tied off the end of the bandage.
You'll send word to Larium, my lord? Sparhawk asked the abbot.
On the next ship that leaves the harbor, Sir Sparhawk.
Sparhawk thought a moment.
I don't think we'll be going back to Mardell, he said. We have some companions staying at the house of the Marquis Lysian there.
The abbot nodded.
I know him, he said. Could you get word to them as well? Tell them that if everything works out at Dabur, we'll be going home from there. I think they might as well go on back to Simara.
I'll see to it, Sparhawk.
Sparhawk tugged thoughtfully at the knot on his bandage.
Leave it alone, Sophronia told him.
He took his hand away. I'm not trying to tell the preceptors what to do, he said to the abbot, but you might suggest in your message that a few small contingents of church knights in the streets of Renderish cities right now might remind the local population of just how unpleasant things can get if they pay too much attention to all these rumors.
And head off the need for whole armies later on, the abbot agreed. I'll definitely mention it in my report.
Sparhawk rose to his feet.
I'm in your debt again, my lord abbot, he said.
You always seem to be here when I need you.
We serve the same master, Sparhawk, the abbot replied.
He grinned then.
Besides, he added, I sort of like you. You Pandions don't always do things the way we would, but you get results and that's what counts, isn't it?
We can hope.
Be careful in the desert, my friend, and good luck.
Thank you, my lord. They went down to the central court of the monastery as the bells began to chime their call to morning prayers. Curic tied Sophronia's sword case to the pack mule's saddle, and they all mounted. Then they rode out through the front gate, with the sound of the bells hovering in the air above them. Sparhawk's mood was pensive as they reached the dusty coast road and turned west toward Jirok.
What is it, Sparhawk? Sophronia asked him.
Those bells have been calling me for 10 years now, he replied.
Somehow I've always known that someday I'd come back to this monastery.
He straightened in his saddle.
It's a good place, he said.
I'm a little sorry to leave it, but... He shrugged and rode on. The morning sun was very bright, and it reflected back blindingly from the wasteland of rock, sand, and gravel lying on the left side of the road. On the right side was a steep bank leading down to a gleaming white beach, and beyond that lay the deep blue waters of the inner sea. Within an hour it was quite warm. A half hour later, it was hot.
Don't they ever get a winter down here? Curic asked, mopping at his streaming face.
This is winter, Curic, Sparhawk told him.
What's it like in the summer?
Unpleasant. In the summer, you have to travel at night.
How far is it to Jirok?
About 500 leagues.
3 weeks, at least.
I'm afraid so.
We should have gone by ship, waterspouts or no.
No, Curic, Sophronia disagreed. None of us could be of any help to Alana if we're all lying on the bottom of the sea.
Won't that thing that's after us just use magic to locate us anyway?
It seems that it can't do that, she replied. When it was looking for Sparhawk 10 years ago, it had to question people. It couldn't just sniff him out.
I'd forgotten that, he admitted.
They rose early each day, even before the stars faded, and pushed their horses hard during the early morning hours before the sun became a bludgeon at midday. Then they rested in the scant shade of the tent the abbot had pressed on them, while their mounts grazed listlessly on scrubby forage in the blistering sun. As the sun lowered toward the west, they rode on, usually until well after dark. Occasionally they reached some desert spring, inevitably surrounded by lush vegetation and shade. At times they lingered for a day to rest their horses and to gather the strength to face the savage sun again. It was at such a spring, where crystal water came purling out of a rocky slope to gather in an azure pool surrounded by palm trees, that the shade of a black-armored Pandion knight visited them. Sparhawk, clad only in a loincloth, had just emerged dripping from the pool when he saw the mounted figure approaching from the west. Although the sun stood at the figure's back, it cast no shadow, and he could clearly see the sun-blasted hillside through both horse and man. Once again he caught that charnel house reek. As the figure approached, he saw that its horse was little more than a vacant-eyed skeleton. He made no attempt to reach a weapon, but stood shivering despite the furnace-like heat as the mounted specter bore down on them. Some few yards away, the shade reined in its skeletal mount, and with a deadly slow motion drew its sword.
"Little mother," it intoned hollowly to Sophronia, "I have done all that I could."
It raised the hilt of its weapon to its visor in a salute, then reversed the blade, and offered the hilt across its insubstantial forearm. Sophronia, pale and faltering, crossed the hot gravel to the specter, and took the sword hilt in both hands.
"Thy sacrifice shall be remembered, Sir Knight," she said in a trembling voice. "What is remembrance in the house of the dead, Sophronia? I did what duty commanded of me. That alone is my solace in the eternal silence."
Then it turned its visored countenance toward Sparhawk.
"Hail, brother," it said in that same empty voice. "Know that thy course is aright. At Dabur shalt thou find that answer which we have sought. Shouldst thou succeed in thy quest, we shall salute thee with our hollow cheers in the house of the dead."
"Hail, brother," Sparhawk replied in a choked voice, "and farewell." Then the specter vanished. With a long shuddering moan, Sophronia collapsed. It was as if the weight of the suddenly materialized sword had crushed her to earth. Curic rushed forward, scooped her slight form up in his arms, and carried her back into the shade beside the pool. Sparhawk, however, moved at a resolute pace toward the spot where she had fallen, heedless of the blistering gravel under his naked feet, and retrieved his fallen brother's sword. Behind him he heard the sound of flute's pipes. The melody was one that he had not heard before. It was questioning and filled with a deep sadness and an aching kind of longing. He turned around with the sword in his hand. Sophronia lay on a blanket in the shade of the palms. Her face seemed drawn, and quite suddenly dark circles had appeared beneath her now closed eyes. Curic knelt anxiously beside her, and Flute sat cross-legged, not far away, with her pipes to her lips, sending her strange hymn-like song soaring into the air. Sparhawk crossed the gravel and stopped in the shade. Curic rose and joined him. "She won't be able to go on today," the squire said quietly. "Perhaps not even tomorrow." Sparhawk nodded. "This is weakening her terribly, Sparhawk," Curic continued gravely. "Each time one of those 12 knights dies, she seems to wilt a little more. Wouldn't it be better to send her back to Simera when we get to Jirok?" "Perhaps so, but she wouldn't go." "You're probably right," Curic agreed glumly. "You do know that you and I could move faster if we didn't have her and the little girl along, though, don't you?" "Yes. But what would we do without her when we got to where we're going?" "You've got a point there, I guess. Did you happen to recognize that ghost?" Sparhawk nodded. "Sir Keres," he said shortly. "I never got to know him very well," Curic admitted. "He always seemed a little stiff and formal." "He was a good man, though." "What did he say to you? I was too far away to hear him." "He said that we're on the right course, and that we'll find the answer we need at Dabur." "Well now," Curic said, "that helps, doesn't it? I was about half afraid that we were chasing shadows." "So was I," Sparhawk admitted. Flute had laid aside her pipes and now sat beside Sophronia. She reached out and took the stricken woman's hand and held it. Her small face was grave, but betrayed no other emotion. An idea came to Sparhawk. He went to where Sophronia lay. "Flute," he said quietly. The little girl looked up at him. "Can you do something to help Sophronia?" Flute shook her head a bit sadly.
It is forbidden.
Sophronia's voice was hardly more than a whisper, and her eyes were still closed.
Only those of us who were present can bear this burden.
She drew in a deep breath.
Go put some clothes on, Sparhawk, she said then.
Don't walk around like that in front of the child. They remained in the shade beside the pool for the remainder of that day and all of the next. On the morning of the third day, Sophronia rose and resolutely began to gather up her things.
Time is moving along, gentlemen, she said crisply, and we still have a long way to go.
Sparhawk looked closely at her. Her face was still haggard, and the deep circles beneath her eyes had not lessened. As she bent to pick up her veil, he saw several silvery strands in her glistening black hair.
Wouldn't you be stronger if we stayed here another day? He asked her.
Not appreciably, Sparhawk, she replied in a weary voice. My condition can't be improved by resting. Let's move on. It's a long way to Jirok.
They rode at an easy pace at first, but after a few miles, Sophronia spoke rather sharply.
Sparhawk, she said, it's going to take all winter if we keep sauntering along like this.
All right, Sophronia, whatever you say.
It was perhaps 10 days later when they arrived in Jirok. Like Cypria, the port city in western Rendor was a low, flat town with thick-walled, flat-roofed houses thickly plastered with white mortar. Sparhawk led them through a series of twisting alleys to a section of town not far from the river. It was a quarter where foreigners were, if not actually encouraged, at least tolerated. While most of the people in the streets were still Rendors, there was a fair spattering of brightly robed Camorians, a number of Lamarks, and even a few Elanians in the crowd. Sparhawk and the others kept their hoods up and rode slowly to avoid attracting attention.
It was late morning when they reached a modest house set some distance back from the street. The man who owned the house was Sir Voran, a Pandion knight, although few in Jirok were aware of that fact.
Most people in the port city thought of him as a moderately prosperous Elanian merchant. He did, in fact, engage in trade. Some years he even made a profit. Sir Voran's real purpose for being in Jirok was not commercial, however. There were a goodly number of Pandion knights submerged in the general population of Rendor, and Voran was their only contact with the mother house at Deimos. All their communications and dispatches passed through his hands to be concealed in the boxes and bales of goods he shipped from the harbor. A slack-lipped servant with dull, uncurious eyes led Sparhawk and the others through the house and on into a walled garden filled with the shade of fig trees and the musical trickle of a marble fountain in the center. Neatly tended flower beds lined the walls, and the nodding blossoms were a riot of colors. Voran was seated on a bench beside the fountain. He was a tall, thin man with a sardonic sense of humor. His years in this southern kingdom had browned his skin until it was the color of an old saddle. Though he was of late middle age, his hair was untouched by gray, but his tanned face was a tracery of wrinkles. He wore no doublet, but rather a plain linen shirt open at the neck. He rose as they entered the garden.
Ah, Makra!
He greeted Sparhawk with a brief sidelong glance at the servant.
So good to see you again, old boy.
Voran, Sparhawk responded with a renderish bow, a sinuous movement that was half genuflection.
Jintal, Voran said to the servant then, be a good fellow and take this to my factor down at the docks.
He folded a sheet of parchment in half and handed it to the swarthy-faced Rendor.
As you command, master, the servant replied, bowing.
They waited until the sound of the front door of the house closing announced that the servant had departed.
Nice enough fellow there, Voran observed. Of course he's fearfully stupid. I'm always careful to hire servants who aren't too bright. An intelligent servant is usually a spy.
Then his eyes narrowed.
Wait here a moment, he said. I want to be sure he really left the house.
He crossed the garden and went back inside.
I don't remember his being that nervous, Kurek said.
This is a nervous part of the world, Sparhawk replied.
After a few moments, Voran returned.
Little mother, he greeted Sophronia warmly, kissing her palms. Will you give me your blessing?
She smiled, touched his forehead, and spoke in Styric.
I've missed that, he confessed.
even though I haven't done much lately that deserves blessing. Then he looked at her more closely.
Aren't you well, Sophronia? He asked her. Your face seems very drawn.
The heat, perhaps, she said, passing a slow hand across her eyes. Sit here, he said, pointing at his marble bench. It's the coolest place in all of Jirok.
He smiled sardonically. Which isn't saying all that much, I'll grant you.
She sat on the bench and Flute clambered up beside her.
Well, Sparhawk, Vorin said, clasping his friend's hand, what brings you back to Jirok so soon? Did you leave something behind, perhaps?
Nothing I can't live without, Sparhawk replied dryly.
Vorin laughed. Just to show you how good a friend I am, I won't tell Lelius that you said that. Hello, Keurig. How's Asladi?
She's well, my lord Vorin.
And your sons? You have three, don't you?
Four, my lord. The last one was born after you left Deimos.
Congratulations, Vorin said. A little late, maybe, but congratulations all the same.
Thank you, my lord. I need to talk with you, Vorin, Sparhawk said, cutting across the pleasantries, and we don't have much time.
And here I thought this was a social visit, Vorin sighed.
Sparhawk let that pass. Has Vanion managed to get word to you about what's been going on in Simura?
The lightly ironic smile faded from Vorin's face, and he nodded seriously.
That's one of the reasons I was surprised to see you, he said. I thought you were going to Barata. Did you have any luck there?
I don't know how lucky it was, but we found out something we're trying to track down.
He clenched his teeth together.
Vorin, he said darkly, Elana was poisoned.
Vorin stared at him for a moment, then swore.
I wonder how long it'd take me to get back to Simura, he said in an icy voice.
I think I'd like to rearrange Anius just a bit. He'd look much better without his head, don't you think?
You'd have to stand in line, my lord Vorin, Keurig assured him. I know at least a dozen other people with the same idea.
Anyway, Sparhawk went on, we found out that it was a renderish poison, and we've heard of a physician in Dabur who might know of an antidote. That's where we're going now.
Where are Calton and the others? Vorin asked. Vanion wrote that you had him and some knights from the other orders with you.
We left them in Madel, Sparhawk replied. They didn't look or act very renderish. Have you heard of a Dr. Tanjin in Dabur?
The one who's reputed to have cured the king's brother of some mysterious ailment?
Of course. He might not want to talk about it, though. There are some shrewd guesses going around about how he managed those cures, and you know how Rendors feel about magic.
I'll persuade him to talk about it, Sparhawk told him. You might wish that you hadn't left Calton and the others behind, Vorin told him. Dabur's a very unfriendly place right now.
I'll have to manage alone. I sent word to them from Cypria to go back home and wait for me there.
Whom did you find in Cypria that you could really trust enough to carry messages for you?
I went to the abbot of that Arshan monastery on the east side of town. I've known him for a long time.
Vorin laughed. Is he still trying to conceal the fact that he's a Cyrenic?
Do you know everything, Vorin?
That's what I'm here for. He's a good man, though. His methods are a little pedestrian, but he gets things done.
What's happening in Dabur right now? Sparhawk asked. I don't want to walk in there with my eyes closed.
Vorin sprawled on the grass near Sophronia's feet and hooked his hands about one knee.
Dabur's always been a strange place, he replied. It was a Shan's home, and the desert nomads think of it as a holy city. At any given time, there are usually a dozen or so religious factions all fighting with each other for control of the holy places there.
He smiled wryly.
Would you believe that there are 23 tombs there, all purporting to be the final resting place of Ashand? I strongly suspect that at least some of them are spurious, unless they dismembered the holy man after his death and buried him piecemeal.
Sparhawk sank to the grass beside his friend.
This is just a thought, he said.
But could we throw some clandestine support to one of the other factions and undermine Arashim's position? It's a nice idea, Sparhawk, but at the moment there aren't any other factions. After Arashim received his epiphany, he spent 40 years exterminating all possible rivals. There was a bloodbath in central Rendor of colossal proportions. Pyramids of skulls dot the desert out there. Finally, he gained control of Dabur, and he rules there with an authority so total that he makes Otha of Zamok look like a liberal. He has thousands of rabid followers who blindly follow his every lunatic whim. They roam the streets with sun-baked brains and burning eyes, searching for any infraction of obscure religious laws. Hordes of the unwashed and lice-ridden, and only marginally human, rage through the streets in search of the opportunity to burn their neighbors at the stake.
That's direct enough, Sparhawk said.
He glanced at Sophronia. Flute had dipped a handkerchief into the fountain and was gently bathing the small woman's face with it. Peculiarly, Sophronia had her head laid against the little girl's shoulder as if she were the child.
Arashim has gathered an army, then? He asked Vorin.
Vorin snorted.
Only an idiot would call it an army. They can't march anywhere because they have to pray every half hour, and they blindly obey even the obvious misstatements of that senile old man.
He laughed harshly. Arashim sometimes stumbles over the language, which isn't surprising since he's probably at least half baboon, and once during his campaigns back in the hinterlands he gave an order. He meant to say, fall upon your foes, but it came out wrong. Instead he said, fall upon your swords, and 3 whole regiments did exactly that. Arashim rode home alone that day, trying to figure out what had gone wrong.
You've been here too long, Vorin, Sparhawk laughed. Rendor's starting to sour your disposition.
I can't abide stupidity and filth, Sparhawk, and Arashim's followers believe devoutly in the sanctity of ignorance and dirt.
You're starting to develop a fine flair for rhetoric, though.
Contempt is a powerful seasoning for one's words, Vorin admitted. I can't say what I think openly here in Rendor, so I have plenty of time to polish my phrases in private.
His face grew serious.
Be very careful in Dabur, Sparhawk, he advised. Arashim has a 2 dozen disciples, some of whom he even knows. They're the ones who really control the city, and they're all as crazy as he is.
That bad?
Worse, probably.
You've always been such a cheerful fellow, Vorin, Sparhawk said dryly.
It's a failing of mine. I try to look on the bright side of things.
Is anything happening in Cypria I ought to know about?
You might want to look into this, Sparhawk said, plucking at the grass beside him. There are some foreigners going about there, trying to encourage the belief that the peasantry in the Aline kingdoms in the north is on the verge of open rebellion against the church, because they support the goals of the Ashandist movement.
I've heard some rumors about that, Vorin said. It hasn't gone very far here in Jirok yet.
It's just a question of time until it does, I think. It's fairly well organized.
Any idea of who's behind it?
Martell. And we all know for whom he works.
The whole idea is to stir up the city dwellers to join with Arashim in an uprising against the church here in Rendor, at the same time that the hierocracy is gathering in Kyrelos to elect a new archprelate. The church knights would have to come here to put the fire out, and that would give Annius and his supporters a free hand in the election. We've passed the word to the militant orders, so they should be able to take steps.
Sparhawk rose from the grass.
How long is your servant likely to take to run his errand? He asked.
It might be better if we were gone when he came back. He may not be too bright, but I know Rendors, and they like to gossip.
I think you've got a little time left. Jintal's fastest pace is a leisurely saunter. You'll have time to eat something, and I'll give you some fresh supplies.
Is there any safe place to stay in Dabur? Sophronia asked the sardonic man.
No place in Dabur is really safe, Sophronia, Vorin replied.
He looked at Sparhawk.
Do you remember Perrain? He asked.
Lean fellow, almost never talks.
That's him.
He's in Dabur, posing as a cattle buyer. He goes by the name Miraluk, and he's got a place near the stockyards. The desert people need him, unless they want to eat all their own cows, so he has more or less the free run of the city. He'll put you up and keep you out of trouble.
Vorin grinned a bit slyly.
Speaking of trouble, Sparhawk, he said, I'd strongly advise you to get out of Jirok before Lilius finds out that you're back.
Is she still unhappy? Sparhawk said.
I thought that she'd have found someone to comfort her by now.
I'm sure she has. Several, probably.
But you know Lilius. She holds grudges.
I left her full title to the shop, Sparhawk said a bit defensively. She should be doing very well by now if she pays attention to business.
The last I heard she was, but that's not the point. The whole thing is that you said your farewells and left your bequest in a note. You didn't give her the chance to scream, weep, and threaten to kill herself.
That was sort of the idea.
You were terribly unkind to her, my friend. Lilius thrives on high drama. When you slipped out in the middle of the night the way you did, you robbed her of a wonderful opportunity for histrionics.
Thorin was grinning openly.
Do you really have to pursue this?
I'm just trying to give you a friendly warning, Sparhawk. All you'll have to face at Dabur are several thousand howling fanatics. Here in Jirok, you'll have to face Lilius, and she's much, much more dangerous.
Chapter 21
They left Vorin's house quietly about a half hour later. Sparhawk looked closely at Sophronia as they mounted their horses. Although it was scarcely past noon, she already looked weary.
Could this thing that's after us stir up a waterspout on the river? He asked her.
She frowned. It's hard to say, she replied. Normally I'd say no, there's not enough open water. But the creatures of the underworld can overcome some natural laws if they choose. She thought a moment.
How wide is the river here? She asked.
Not very, he replied. There's not enough water in the whole of Rendor to make a wide river.
The river banks would make it very hard to direct a spout, she said thoughtfully. You saw how erratically the one that destroyed Mabin's ship was moving.
We'll have to chance it then, he said. You're too exhausted to ride all the way to Dabur, and it's going to get hotter as we ride south.
Don't take unnecessary chances just for my sake, Sparhawk.
It's not entirely for your sake, he told her. We've lost a lot of time already, and going by boat is faster than riding. We'll stay close to the riverbank in case we need to get off the boat in a hurry.
Whatever you think best, she said, slumping slightly in her saddle.
They rode out into the teeming street where black-robed nomads from the desert mingled with the more brightly garbed city dwellers and the merchants from the northern kingdoms. The street was filled with noise and with those peculiarly renderish scents, spices, perfumes, and the pervading odor of smoking olive oil.
"Who's this Lilius?" Curic asked curiously as they rode down along the street toward the river.
"It's not important," Sparhawk replied shortly.
"If this person is dangerous, I'd say that it's fairly important for me to know about it."
"Lilius isn't dangerous in that particular way."
"We're talking about a woman, I gather."
It was obvious that Curic did not intend to be put off. Sparhawk made a sour face.
"All right," he said. "I was here in Jirok for 10 years. Vorin set me up in a little shop where I went by the name Makra. The idea was that I could drop out of sight so that Martell's hirelings couldn't find me. In order to keep busy, I gathered information for Vorin. To do that, I needed to look like all the other merchants on that street. They all had mistresses, so I needed one too. Her name was Lilius. Satisfied?"
"That was quick.
The lady has a short temper, I take it?"
"No, Curic, she has a very long one. Lilius is the kind of woman who nurses grudges."
"Oh, that kind. I'd like to meet her."
"No, you wouldn't. I don't think you'd care for all the screaming and dramatics."
"That bad?
Why do you think I slipped out of town in the middle of the night?"
"Do you suppose we could drop this?"
Curic started to chuckle.
"Excuse me for laughing, my lord," he said, "but as I recall, you weren't exactly brimming with sympathy when I told you about my indiscretion with Talon's mother."
"All right, we're even then." Sparhawk clamped his lips shut and rode on, ignoring Curic's laughter. The docks that jutted out into the muddy flow of the Goulet River were rickety affairs, and they were draped with smelly fishnets,
Dozens of the wide-beamed riverboats that plied the stream between Jirok and Dabur were moored to them. Dark-skinned sailors, clad in loincloths and with cloths wound about their heads, lounged on their decks. Sparhawk dismounted and approached an evil-looking one-eyed man in a loose-fitting striped robe. The one-eyed man stood on the dock bawling orders at a lazy-looking trio of sailors aboard a mud-smeared scow.
"Your boat?" the knight asked.
"What of it?"
"Is it for hire?"
"That depends on the price."
"We can work that out.
How many days to Dabur?"
3, maybe 4 days, depending on the wind."
The captain was assessing Sparhawk and the others with his good eye. His surly expression changed, and he smiled an oily smile.
"Why don't we talk about the price, noble sir?" he suggested.
Sparhawk made some pretense at haggling, then dipped into the pouch of coins Vorin had given him and counted silver into the riverman's grimy hand. The man's single eye came alight when he saw the pouch. They boarded the boat and tethered their horses amidships, as the 3 sailors slipped the hawsers, pushed the boat out into the current and raised the single slanted sail. The river was sluggish, and the stiff onshore breeze blowing in off the Arshan Strait pushed them upstream against the current at a goodly speed.
"Watch yourselves," Sparhawk muttered to his companions as they unsaddled their mounts. "Our captain appears to be an independent businessman with his eye open for opportunities."
He walked aft to where the one-eyed man stood at the tiller.
"I want you to keep as close to shore as you can," he said.
"What for?"
The captain's lone eye became suddenly wary.
"My sister's afraid of water," Sparhawk improvised. "If I give you the word, put your boat up against the bank so that she can get off."
"You're paying,"
the captain shrugged.
"We'll do it any way you like."
"Do you run at night?" Sparhawk asked him.
The captain shook his head.
"Some do, but I don't. There are too many snags and hidden rocks for my taste. We moor up against the bank when it gets dark."
"Good. I like prudence in a sailor. It makes for safer journeys."
"Which brings up a point."
He opened the front of his robe to reveal his mail coat and the heavy broadsword belted at his side.
"Do you get my meaning?" he asked.
The captain's face clouded with chagrin.
"You have no right to threaten me on my own boat," he blustered.
"As you said before, I'm paying."
"Your crew looks a little undependable to me, Captain, and your own face isn't one to inspire trust."
The captain's face grew sullen.
"You don't have to be insulting," he said.
"If I've misjudged you, I'll apologize later.
We have certain valuables with us, and we'd prefer to keep them. My friends and I will sleep on the foredeck. You and your men can sleep aft. I trust that won't inconvenience you too much."
"Aren't you being a little overcautious?"
"Nervous times, neighbor. Nervous times. Remember, when we tie up to the bank for the night, keep your men on the aft deck and warn them against sleepwalking. A boat can be a very dangerous place for that sort of thing, and I'm a light sleeper."
He turned and walked back forward.
The river banks on either side were covered with thick, rank vegetation, though the hills rising behind those narrow strips of green were barren and rock-strewn.
Sparhawk and his friends sat on the foredeck, keeping a careful eye on the captain and his sailors, and watching for any signs of unusual-looking weather. Flute sat astride the bowsprit, playing her pipes, while Sparhawk spoke quietly with Sophrenia and Curic. Sophrenia already knew the customs of the country, so Sparhawk's instruction was directed primarily at his squire. He cautioned him about the many minor things that could be taken as personal insults, and about other things that were considered sacrilegious.
"Who made up all these stupid rules?" Curic demanded.
"Eshand," Sparhawk replied. "He was crazy, and crazy people take great comfort in rituals."
"Anything else?"
"One other thing. If you should happen to encounter any sheep, you have to step aside for them."
"Say that again?"
Curic's tone was incredulous.
"It's very important, Curic."
"You're not serious."
"Deadly serious. Eshand was a shepherd when he was a boy, and he used to go absolutely wild when someone rode through his flock. When he came to power, he announced that God had revealed to him that sheep were holy animals, and that everyone had to give way to them."
"That's crazy, Sparhawk,"
Curic protested.
Of course it is. It's the law here, though.
Isn't it strange how the Aline God's revelations always seem to coincide exactly with the prejudices of his prophets? Sophronia murmured.
Do they do anything at all like normal people? Curic asked.
Not many things, no.
As the sun went down, the captain moored his boat against the riverbank, and he and his sailors spread pallets on the aft deck. Sparhawk rose and went amidships. He laid his hand on Farron's neck.
Stay awake, he told the big roan. If someone starts creeping around in the middle of the night, let me know about it.
Farron bared his teeth and shifted around until he was resolutely facing aft. Sparhawk patted his rump familiarly and went back forward. They took a cold supper of bread and cheese, then spread their blankets on the deck.
Sparhawk, Curic said after they had settled down for the night.
Yes, Curic.
I just had a thought. Are there many people riding in and out of Dabur?
Usually, yes.
Arashim's presence there tends to attract large crowds.
I sort of thought so.
Wouldn't we be a little less conspicuous if we got off this boat a league or so this side of Dabur and joined one of the groups of pilgrims riding into the city?
You think of everything, don't you, Curic?
That's what you pay me for, Sparhawk. Sometimes you knights aren't too practical. It's a squire's job to keep you out of trouble.
I appreciate that, Curic.
No extra charge, Curic said.
The night passed uneventfully, and at dawn the sailors cast off their moorings and raised the sail again. They passed the town of Kozel about mid-morning of the following day, and sailed on upriver toward the holy city of Dabur. The river between the two towns was heavily traveled. There seemed to be no organized pattern to the traffic, and the boats occasionally bumped into each other. Such incidents were usually accompanied by an exchange of curses and insults. It was about noon on the fourth day when Sparhawk went aft to have a word with the one-eyed captain.
"We're getting fairly close, aren't we?" he asked.
"About 5 more leagues," the captain replied, moving his tiller slightly to avoid an oncoming boat.
"Mangy son of a 3-legged donkey," he bellowed at the steersman of the other vessel.
"May your mother break out in warts,"
the steersman replied pleasantly.
"I think my friends and I might want to go ashore before we actually reach the city," Sparhawk said to the captain. "We want to look around a bit before we meet any of Arashim's followers, and the docks are likely to be watched rather closely."
"That might be a wise move," the captain agreed. "Besides, I get a feeling that you might be up to no good, and I'd rather not get involved."
"It works out for both of us, then, doesn't it?"
It was early afternoon when the captain put his tiller over and drove the prow of his boat up onto a narrow strip of sandy beach.
"This is about as close as I can get you," he told Sparhawk. "The bank gets marshy just up ahead."
"How far is Dabur from here?" Sparhawk asked him.
4, maybe 5 miles."
"Close enough, then."
The sailors ran the gangway out to the sand from amidships, and Sparhawk and his friends led their horses and their pack mule down to the beach. They had no sooner disembarked than the sailors pulled in the gangway and pushed the boat out into the river with long poles. Then the captain maneuvered his craft out into the current and moved back down the river. There was no exchange of farewells.
"Are you going to be all right?" Sparhawk asked Sophronia.
Her face was still drawn, although the dark circles under her eyes had begun to fade.
"I'll be fine, Sparhawk," she assured him.
"If we lose too many more of those knights, though, you won't be, will you?"
"I don't really know," she replied. "I've never been in this exact position before.
Let's go on to Dabur and talk with Dr. Tungin."
They rowed up off the beach through the scrubby bushes that bordered it and soon reached the dusty road that led to Dabur. There were other travelers on that road, black-robed nomads for the most part, with their dark eyes afire with religious fervor. Once they were forced to the side of the road by a herd of sheep. The herders, mounted on mules, rode arrogantly and deliberately blocked the road as much as possible with their animals. Their expressions clearly dared anyone to object.
"I never liked sheep very much," Curic muttered, "and I like sheep herders even less."
"Don't let it show," Sparhawk advised him.
"They eat a lot of mutton down here, don't they?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"Isn't it sort of inconsistent to butcher and eat a sacred animal?"
Consistency is not one of the more notable characteristics of the renderish mind. As the sheep passed, Flute raised her pipes and played a peculiarly discordant little melody. The sheep suddenly grew wild-eyed, milled for a moment, then stampeded across the desert with the sheepherders in frantic pursuit. Flute covered her mouth with a soundless giggle.
"Stop that," Sophronia chided.
"Did what I think happened just happen?" Keurig said in amazement.
"I wouldn't be at all surprised," Sparhawk said.
"I really like that little girl, you know." Keurig was grinning broadly. They rode on at the tail end of a crowd of pilgrims. After a time, they crested a low hill and saw the city of Dabur spread out below them. There were the usual white-plastered houses clustered near the river, but beyond them, stretching in all directions, were hundreds of large black tents. Sparhawk shaded his eyes with one hand and scanned the city. "The cattle pens are over there," he said, pointing to the eastern edge of town. "We should be able to find Perrain there somewhere." They angled down the hill, avoiding the buildings and tents in the southern section of Dabur. As they began to ride through a cluster of tents pitched between them and the pens, a bearded nomad with a brass pendant set with a bit of glass hanging on a chain about his neck stepped out from behind a tent to bar their path.
"Where do you think you're going?" he demanded.
He made a quick, imperious gesture with one hand, and a dozen other black-robed men came out into the open with long pikes in their hands.
"We have business at the cattle pens, noble sir," Sparhawk replied mildly.
"Oh, really?" the bearded man sneered. "I see no cows."
He looked around at his followers with a self-congratulatory smirk, as if terribly pleased with his own cleverness.
"The cows are coming, noble sir," Sparhawk told him. "We were sent on ahead to make arrangements."
The man with the pendant knit his brows, trying hard to find something wrong with that.
"Do you know who I am?"
he demanded finally in a pugnacious tone of voice.
"I'm afraid not, noble sir," Sparhawk apologized.
"I haven't had the pleasure of making your acquaintance." "You think you're very clever, don't you?"
the officious fellow demanded.
"All these soft answers don't deceive me in the least."
"I wasn't trying to be deceptive, neighbor," Sparhawk said with a slight edge coming into his voice. "Merely polite."
"I am Ulysses, favored disciple of Holy Arashim,"
the bearded man said, striking his chest with his fist.
"I'm overwhelmed by the honor of meeting you," Sparhawk said, bowing in his saddle.
"That's all you have to say?"
Ulysses exclaimed, his eyes bulging at the imagined insult.
"As I said, Lord Ulysses, I'm overwhelmed. I hadn't expected to be greeted by so illustrious a man."
"I'm not here to greet you, cowherd. I'm here to take you into custody. Get down off your horses."
Sparhawk gave him a long look, assessing the situation. Then he swung down from Farron's back and helped Sophronia to dismount.
"What's this all about, Sparhawk?" she whispered as she lifted Flute down.
"I'd guess that he's a minor bootlicker trying to assert his own importance," Sparhawk whispered back. "We don't want to stir anything up, so let's do as he says."
"Take the prisoners to my tent," Ulysses commanded grandly after a moment's hesitation.
The favored disciple didn't seem to know exactly what to do. The pikemen stepped forward threateningly, and one of them led the way toward a tent surmounted by a dropping pennon made of dirty green cloth. They were roughly shoved into the tent, and the flap was tied down. Keurig's expression was filled with contempt.
"Amateurs," he muttered. "They hold those pikes like shepherd's crooks, and they didn't even search us for weapons."
"They may be amateurs, Keurig," Sophronia said softly, "but they've managed to take us prisoner."
"Not for long," Keurig growled, reaching under his rope for his dagger. "I'll cut a hole in the back of the tent and we can be on our way."
"No," Sparhawk said quietly. "We'd have a horde of howling fanatics on our heels in about 2 minutes if we did that."
"We're not just going to sit here," Keurig asked incredulously.
"Let me handle it, Keurig."
They sat waiting in the stifling tent as the minutes dragged by. After a bit, the tent flap opened, and Ulysses entered with two of his men close behind him.
"I will have your name from you, cowherd," he said arrogantly.
"I am called Makra, Lord Ulysses,"
Sparhawk replied meekly. And this is my sister, her daughter, and my servant. May I ask why we have been detained?
Ulysses' eyes narrowed.
There are those who refuse to accept Holy Arasham's authority, he declared. I, Ulysses, his most favored disciple, have taken it upon myself to root out these false prophets and send them to the stake. Holy Arasham relies upon me completely.
Is that still going on? Sparhawk asked in mild surprise. I thought that all opposition to Arasham had been stamped out decades ago.
Not so, not so! Ulysses half shrieked. There are still plotters and conspirators hiding in the desert and lurking in the cities. I will not rest until I have unearthed every one of these criminals and consigned them to the flames.
You have nothing to fear from me or my band, Lord Ulysses, Sparhawk assured him. We revere the holy prophet of God and pay him homage in our prayers.
So you say, Makra. But can you prove your identity and satisfy me that you have legitimate business in the holy city?
The fanatic smirked at his two cohorts as if he had just scored a tremendous point.
Why, yes, Lord Ulysses, Sparhawk replied calmly. I believe I can. We are here to speak with a cattle buyer named Miralek. Do you perhaps know him?
Ulysses puffed himself up.
What would I, the favored disciple of Holy Arasham, have to do with some common cattle buyer?
One of the disciples' toadies leaned forward and whispered at some length in Ulysses' ear. The disciple's expression grew less and less certain, and finally even a bit frightened.
I will send for this cattle buyer you mentioned, he declared grudgingly. If he confirms your story, well and good. But if not, I will take you to Holy Arasham himself for judgment.
As the Lord Ulysses wishes, Sparhawk bowed. If you would have your messenger tell Miralek that Makra is here with greetings from his little mother, I'm sure he'll come here immediately and clear up this whole matter.
You'd better hope so, Makra, the bearded disciple said threateningly.
He turned to the toady who had whispered in his ear.
Go fetch this Miralek. Repeat the message of this cowherd to him and tell him that I, Ulysses, favored disciple of Holy Arasham, command his presence immediately.
At once, favored one, the fellow replied and scurried from the tent.
Ulysses glowered at Sparhawk for a moment. Then he and his other sycophant left the tent. You've still got your sword, Sparhawk, Keurig said. Why didn't you just let the air out of that windbag? I could have dealt with the other two.
It wasn't necessary. Sparhawk shrugged.
I know Perrain well enough to know that by now he's managed to make himself indispensable to Arasham. He'll be here shortly and put Ulysses, favored disciple of Holy Arasham, in his place.
Aren't you gambling, Sparhawk? Sophronia asked. What if Perrain doesn't recognize the name Makra? As I recall, you were in Jirok, and he's been here in Dabur for years.
He may not recognize the name I go by here in Rendor, Sparhawk replied. But he can't fail to recognize yours, little mother. It's a very old password. The Pandions have been using it for years.
She blinked. I'm very flattered, she said. But why didn't someone tell me?
Sparhawk turned to her in some surprise.
We all thought you knew.
It was perhaps a quarter of an hour later when Ulysses escorted a lean, saturnine man in a striped robe into the tent. Ulysses's manner was obsequious, and his expression worried.
This is the fellow I was telling you about, honored Miralek, he fawned.
Ah, Makra,
the lean man said, coming forward to take Sparhawk's hand warmly in his own.
So good to see you again. What seems to be the trouble here?
A slight misunderstanding is all, Miralek, Sparhawk replied, bowing slightly to his fellow Pandion.
Well, that's all straightened out now.
Sir Perrain turned to the favored disciple.
Isn't it, Ulysses?
Oh, of course, honored Miralek.
Ulysses faltered, his face visibly pale now.
Whatever possessed you to detain my friends?
Perrain's tone was mild, but there was a slight edge to it.
I'm only trying to protect Holy Arasham.
Oh? And did he ask for your protection?
Well, not in so many words.
I see. That was very brave of you, Ulysses. Surely you know how Holy Arasham feels about those who act independently of his instructions.
Many have lost their heads for taking too much upon themselves. Ulysses began to tremble violently. I'm sure he'll forgive you when I tell him of the incident, however. A lesser man would be sent to the block immediately, but after all, you're his favorite disciple, aren't you? Was there anything else, Ulysses? Mutely, his face pasty white, Ulysses shook his head. My friends and I will be going, then. Coming, Makra. Cyperaine led them from the tent. As they rode through the city of tents that had grown up on the outskirts of Dabur, Perrine talked at length about how depressed the cattle market currently was. The tents they passed had apparently been pitched at random. There was nothing resembling a street. Hordes of dirty children ran and played in the sand, and dispirited-looking dogs rose from the shady side of each tent they passed to bark indifferently a few times before returning to flop down out of the sun again. Perrine's house was a square block-like structure that stood in the center of a patch of weedy ground just beyond the tents. "Come inside," the knight told them loudly as they reached the door. "I want to hear more about this cattle herd of yours." They went in and he closed the door. It was dim and cool inside. The house had but a single room. There were rudimentary cooking facilities on one side and an unmade bed on the other. A number of large, porous jugs hung from the rafters, each seeping moisture which dripped into puddles on the floor. A table and two benches sat in the middle of the room. "It's none too ornate," Perrine apologized. Sparhawk looked meaningfully at the lone window at the back of the house, a window that seemed only loosely shuttered. "Is it safe to talk?" he asked in a low voice. Perrine laughed. "Oh, yes, Sparhawk," he replied. "In my spare time I've been nurturing a thorn bush outside that window. You'd be amazed at how much it's grown, and how long the thorns are." "You're looking well, my friend. I haven't seen you since we were novices." Perrine spoke with the faintest trace of an accent. Unlike most Pandions, he was not an Alanian, but came instead from somewhere in the vast reaches of Central Eosia. Sparhawk had always liked him. "You seem to have learned how to talk, Perrine," Sophrenia said. "You were always so silent before." He smiled. "It was my accent, little mother," he said. "I didn't want people making fun of me." He took her wrists and kissed her palms in greeting and asked her blessing. "You remember Curic?" Sparhawk said. "Of course," Perrine replied. "He trained me with the lance. Hello, Curic. How's Asladi?" "Very well, Sir Perrine," Curic said. "I'll tell her you asked. What was that business back there all about, with Ulysses, I mean?" "He's one of the officious toads who've attached themselves to Arashim." "Is he really a disciple?" Perrine snorted. "I doubt that Arashim even knows his name," he said. "Of course, there are days when Arashim doesn't even know his own. There are dozens like Ulysses, self-appointed disciples who go around bothering honest people. He's probably 5 miles out into the desert by now and riding very hard to get away. Arashim is very firm with people who overstep what little authority he gives them. Why don't we all sit down?" "How did you manage to accumulate so much power, Perrine?" Sophrenia asked him. "Ulysses behaved as if you were some kind of king." "It wasn't really too hard," he replied. "Arashim has only 2 teeth in his head, and they don't meet. I give him a tender, milk-fed veal every other week as a token of my unspeakable regard for him. Old men are very interested in their bellies, so Arashim is profuse in his thanks. The disciples aren't blind, so they defer to me because of Arashim's supposed favor. Now, what brings you to Dabur?"
"Vorin suggested that we look you up," Sparhawk said. "We need to talk with someone here, and we didn't want to attract too much attention."
"My house is yours," Perrine said ironically, "such as it is. Who is it you need to talk with?"
"A physician named Tamjin," Sophrenia told him, removing her veil.
Perrine looked at her rather closely. "You are looking a bit unwell, Sophrenia," he said. "But couldn't you find a physician in Jirok?"
She smiled briefly. "It's not for me, Perrine," she told him. "It has to do with someone else. Do you know this Tamjin?"
"Everybody in Dabur knows him. He keeps quarters in the back of an apothecary shop in the central square. His house is being watched, though. There are rumors going about that he dabbles in magic sometimes, and the zealots have been trying to catch him at it."
"It might be better to walk to the square, wouldn't you say?" Sparhawk asked. Perrine nodded. And I think we'll wait until just before the sun goes down. That way we'll have some darkness when we come out, just in case we need it. You want me to go with you? It might be better if Sophronia and I went alone, Sparhawk replied. You have to stay here, and we don't. If Tanjin's under suspicion, visiting him could jeopardize your position here in Dabur. Stay out of alleys, Sparhawk, Curic growled. Sparhawk motioned to Flute, and she came to him obediently. He put his hands on her shoulders and looked directly into her face. I want you to stay here with Curic, he told her. She looked at him gravely, then impudently crossed her eyes at him. Stop that, he said. Listen to me, young lady, I'm serious. Just ask her, Sparhawk, Sophronia advised. Don't try to order her around. Please, Flute, he implored. Will you please stay here? She smiled sweetly, put her hands together in front of her, and curtsied. You see how easy it is? Sophronia said. Since we've got some time, I'll fix you all something to eat, Perrine said, rising to his feet. Did you know that all your bottles are leaking, Sir Perrine? Curic said, pointing at the dripping vessels hanging from the rafters. Yes, Perrine replied. They make a mess on the floor, but they help to keep it cool in here. He went to the hearth and fumbled for a few moments with flint, steel, and tinder. He built up a very small fire of twigs and twisted chunks of the branches of desert shrubs. Then he set a kettle on the fire, took a large pan, and poured oil in it. He set the pan on the coals and took several chunks of meat out of a covered bowl. As the oil began to smoke, he dropped the meat into the pan. I'm afraid it's only mutton, he apologized. I wasn't expecting company. He spiced the sizzling meat liberally to disguise its flavor, then brought heavy plates to the table. He went back to the fire and opened an earthenware jar. He took a pinch of tea from the jar, dropped it into a mug, and poured hot water from the kettle into the mug. For you, little mother, he said, delivering the mug to her with a flourish. How very nice, she said. You're such a dear, Perrine. I live but to serve, he said a bit grandiosely. He brought fresh figs and a slab of cheese to the table, then set the smoking pan in the center of it. You've missed your calling, my friend, Sparhawk said. I learned to cook for myself a long time ago. I could afford a servant, but I don't trust strangers. He sat down. Be careful out there, Sparhawk, he cautioned as they began to eat. Arasham's followers are a bit limp between the ears, and they're all obsessed with the idea of catching some neighbor committing a minor transgression. Arasham preaches every evening after the sun goes down, and he manages to come up with some new prohibition every night. What's the latest one? Sparhawk said. Killing flies. He says that they're the messengers of God. You're not serious. Perrine shrugged. I think he's running out of things to forbid, and his imagination is severely limited. You want some more of this mutton? Thanks all the same, Perrine, Sparhawk said, taking a fig instead. But one chunk of mutton is my limit. One chunk a day? No, one a year. Chapter 22 The sun was turning the western sky a rusty color when Sparhawk and Sophronia entered the square near the center of Dabur, and the light reflecting from the late afternoon sky bathed the walls of the buildings and the faces of the people in the square with a ruddy glow. Sophronia had her left arm bound up in a makeshift sling, and Sparhawk held her other elbow solicitously as they walked. It's right over there, he said quietly, nodding his head toward the far side. Sophronia drew her veil a bit tighter across her nose and mouth, and they moved through the crowd milling around in the middle of the square. Here and there along the walls of the buildings leaned hooded nomads in black robes, their eyes alert and filled with suspicion as they peered at every face that passed. True believers, Sparhawk muttered sardonically, ever alert for the sins of their neighbors. It's always been that way, Sparhawk, she replied. Self-righteousness is one of the most common and least attractive characteristics of man. They passed one of the watchers and entered the smelly shop. The apothecary was a chubby little man with an apprehensive expression on his face. I don't know if he'll consent to see you, he said when they asked to speak with Dr. Tanjin. He's being watched, you know. Yes, Sparhawk said. We saw several of the watchers outside. Please advise him that we're here. My sister's arm needs attention. The nervous apothecary scurried through a curtained doorway at the back of the shop. A moment later, he came back.
"I'm sorry," he apologized. "He said he's not taking any new patients."
Sparhawk raised his voice.
"How can a healer refuse to see an injured person? Does the oath they take mean so little to them here in Dabur? In Cypria, the physicians are more honorable. My good friend Dr. Voldy would never refuse his aid to the sick or hurt."
It hung there for a moment, and then the curtains parted. The man who thrust his head out between them had a very large nose, a pendulous lower lip, jutting ears, and weak, watery eyes. He wore the white smock of a physician.
"Did you say Voldy?"
he asked in a high-pitched nasal voice.
"Do you know him?"
"Of course," Sparhawk replied. "He's a small man who's going bald, and he dyes his hair. He has a very large opinion of himself."
"That's Voldy, all right. Bring your sister back here, and be quick. Don't let anybody outside the shop see you."
Sparhawk took Sophronia's elbow and escorted her back through the curtains.
"Did anyone see you come in?"
the big-nosed man asked nervously. "Any number of them, I'd imagine," Sparhawk shrugged. "They line the walls of the square like a flock of vultures trying to sniff out sin."
"It's not safe to talk that way in Dabur, my friend," Tunjin warned.
"Perhaps." Sparhawk looked around. The room was shabby and was piled high in the corners with open wooden boxes and stacks of books. A persistent bumblebee batted its head against the single dirty window, trying to get out. There was a low couch against one wall, and several straight-backed wooden chairs and a table in the center.
"Shall we get down to business, Dr. Tunjin?" he suggested.
"All right," the physician said to Sophronia. "Sit here, and I'll have a look at that arm."
"You may, if it's going to make you happy, doctor," she replied, taking the chair and removing her arm from the sling. She pulled back the sleeve of her robe to reveal a surprisingly girlish arm. The doctor looked a bit hesitantly at Sparhawk.
"You understand, of course, that I'm not being forward with your sister's person, but I must examine her."
"I understand the procedure, doctor."
Tunjin took a deep breath and then bent Sophronia's wrist back and forth several times. Then he gently ran his fingers up her forearm and bent her elbow. He swallowed hard and probed at her upper arm. Then he moved her arm up and down with his fingers, lightly touching her shoulder. His close-set eyes narrowed.
"There's nothing wrong with this arm," he accused.
"How kind you are to say so," she murmured, removing her veil.
"Madam,"
he said in a shocked voice,
"cover yourself."
"Oh, do be serious, doctor," she told him. "We're not here to talk about arms and legs."
"You're spies," he gasped.
"In a manner of speaking, yes," she replied calmly. "But even spies have reason to consult with physicians once in a while."
"Leave at once," he ordered.
"We just got here," Sparhawk said, pushing back his hood.
"Go ahead, sister dear," he said to Sophronia. "Tell him why we're here."
"Tell me, Tunjin," she said. "Does the word Daristim mean anything to you?"
He started guiltily and looked at the curtained doorway, backing away from her.
"Don't be modest, doctor," Sparhawk told him. "Word's been going about that you cured the king's brother and several of his nephews after they'd been poisoned with Daristim."
"There's no proof of that."
"I don't need proof. I need a cure. A friend of ours has the same condition."
"There's no antidote or cure for Daristim."
"Then how is it that the king's brother still lives?"
"You're working with them,"
the doctor accused, pointing vaguely out toward the square.
"You're trying to trick me into a confession."
"Them who?" Sparhawk asked.
"The fanatics who follow Arashim. They're trying to prove that I use witchcraft in my practice."
"Do you?"
The doctor shrank back.
"Please leave," he begged. "You're putting my life in terrible danger."
"As you probably noticed, doctor," Sophronia said, "we are not renderish. We do not share the prejudices of your countrymen, so magic does not offend us. It's quite routine in the place we come from."
He blinked at her uncertainly.
"This friend of ours, the one I mentioned before, is very dear to us," Sparhawk told him, "and we'll go to any lengths to find a cure for this poison."
To emphasize his point, he opened his robe.
"Any lengths at all." The doctor gaped at his mail coat and sheathed sword.
"There's no need to threaten the doctor, brother dear,"
Sophronia said. I'm sure he'll be more than happy to describe the cure he's found. He is a healer, after all.
Madam, I don't know what you're talking about, Tanjin said desperately. There is no cure for Daristim. I don't know where you heard all these rumors, but I can assure you that they're absolutely false. I do not use witchcraft in my practice.
He threw another quick, nervous glance at the curtained doorway. But Dr. Voldy and Cypria told us that you did, in fact, cure members of the king's family.
Well, yes, I suppose I did, but the poison wasn't Daristim.
What was it, then?
Porgata, I think.
He was obviously lying.
Then why was it that the king sent for you, Doctor? She pressed.
A simple purge will cleanse the body of Porgata. Any apprentice physician knows that. Surely it couldn't have been so mild a poison.
Well, maybe it was something else. I forget exactly.
I think, dear brother, Sophronia said then to Sparhawk, that the good doctor needs some reassurance. Some positive proof that he can trust us, and that we are what we say we are.
She looked at the irritating bumblebee, still stubbornly trying to break its way out through the window.
Have you ever wondered why you never see a bumblebee at night, Doctor? She asked the frightened physician.
I've never given it any thought.
Perhaps you should.
She began to murmur in Styric as her fingers wove the designs of the spell.
What are you doing?
Tanjin exclaimed.
Stop that!
He started to move toward her with one hand outstretched, but Sparhawk stopped him.
Don't interfere, the big knight said.
Then Sophronia pointed her finger and released the spell. The buzzing sound of insect wings was suddenly joined by a tiny piping voice that sang joyously in a tongue unknown to man. Sparhawk looked quickly at the dust-clouded window. The bumblebee was gone, and in its place there hovered a tiny female figure directly out of folklore. Her pale hair cascaded down her back between her rapidly beating gossamer wings. Her little nude body was perfectly formed, and her minuscule face was so lovely as to stop the breath.
That is how bumblebees think of themselves, Sophronia said quite calmly. And perhaps that is what they truly are. By day a common insect, but by night a creature of wonder.
Tanjin had fallen back on his shabby couch with his eyes wide and his mouth agape.
Come here, little sister, Sophronia crooned to the fairy, extending one hand.
The fairy swooped about the room, her transparent wings buzzing and her tiny voice soaring. Then she delicately settled on Sophronia's outstretched palm, with her wings still fanning at the air. Sophronia turned and stretched her hand out to the shaking physician.
Isn't she beautiful? She asked.
You may hold her if you like, but be wary of her sting. She pointed at the tiny rapier in the fairy's hand. Tanjin shrank away with his hands behind his back.
How did you do that?
He asked in a trembling voice.
Do you mean that you can't?
The charges against you must be false, then. This is a very simple spell, quite rudimentary, actually. As you can see, Doctor, Sparhawk said, we have no qualms about magic. You can speak freely to us with no fear of being denounced to Arashim or his fanatic followers. Tanjin tightly clamped his lips shut, continuing to stare at the fairy seated sedately on Sophronia's palm with fluttering wings.
Don't be tiresome, Doctor, Sophronia said. Just tell us how you cured the king's brother and we'll be on our way.
Tanjin began to edge away from her.
I think, dear brother, that we're wasting our time here, she said to Sparhawk. The good doctor refuses to cooperate.
She raised her hand.
End of side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.